Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take for a soldier returning from combat to return to normal? Some come back with life-threatening wounds, but even those who escape physical injuries often report serious problems adjusting to civilian life after a tour of duty in Iraq or Afghanistan. And those difficulties can be greatly magnified by mental health problems that may develop as a result of the trauma of living and working under life and death pressure for months at a time. There is help available, as my guest today can explain. Dr. Catherine J. Cotterla is chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Texas A&M Health Science Center. She's in town for a conference on Operation Healthy Reunions. That's a program administered in part by Mental Health America of Greater Dallas that supports mental health care and case management for veterans who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan and for their families. Dr. Cotterla, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this. What sorts of screening is done ahead of time to determine that soldiers are mentally fit to go to war in the first place?
Soldiers fill out a checklist. It's a good thing. It's a great thing. The problem with that, though, is soldiers watch out for each other. So at times, when soldiers are getting ready to go back to Iraq or Afghanistan, they minimize any distress they're experiencing because they don't want to let their buddies down. Now, when they come back, likewise, they want to stay with their friends and keep them protected. So even if they're experiencing distress, they don't acknowledge it.
And I'm wondering how often they come back and they have their sort of exit interview, if you will, and the problems haven't really set in yet that they might experience later on.
That's an excellent point. We certainly learned that after Vietnam. The average time it took for soldiers to experience difficulties after Vietnam was 7 years. We really anticipate after Iraq or Afghanistan, folks will come back, they'll go home, they'll go back to work, they'll be in the home 3 months, 6 months, 9 months later, 2 years later. The consequences of being deployed will start showing in the family and at work.
The other, I suppose, good thing, definitely a good thing about this war is that our defensive and protective gear has gotten so much better that a lot more men and women are surviving injuries that would have killed them previously, but they're much more badly wounded.
Yes, you're right. And we see the physical wounds. We see the loss of limb. We see the severe burns. But a key point to keep in mind is we're also seeing unprecedented amounts of traumatic brain injury for exactly the reason you described. They survive repeated exposures to explosions and suffer very subtle jostling of their brain. What that can show up as back in America includes a difficulty concentrating, a problem with attention, irritability, an ease of displaying anger. So these very subtle changes in personality and ability to think that they may not even associate with exposure to a blast.
So in other words, they can have a traumatic brain injury without a gaping wound in the side of their head.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm so glad you said that. It's really characteristic. And that is, in fact, why that is considered the hidden signature injury of this war.
And is that injury always permanent?
No. The great thing about traumatic brain injury is that often it does go away. What we really don't know with this conflict, though, is that soldiers are experiencing multiple small traumatic brain injuries. We really don't know what the consequences will be. We don't know if it will go away like many normal traumatic brain injuries do, or if it requires at least some kind of intervention. That remains to be seen. Certainly identifying it and letting their families know what is happening would be beneficial.
What are soldiers told to look for when they return that would be a sign that something is not right? Because everyone understands that readjusting is a challenge regardless.
Yeah, and I really have to give our Texas Military Forces, that's our Guard and Reserve, and certainly the Department of Defense, great credit. They're training our soldiers on what to expect. Our soldiers are having briefings about PTSD. They're filling out checklists about stress symptoms or depression. The question that we were discussing in our conference today that keeps coming up is, are we really talking to our soldiers in a way and at a time when they want to listen? We are providing the education, but are we doing it when they're ready to hear? What soldiers tell me is that they come home, they deny anything's wrong, their family notices something's wrong. And their family may or may not be equipped to recognize it. And even if they recognize it, they may not be able to convince their soldier to seek services.
Well, the denial sounds pretty reasonable if you think about people wanting to come back, and all they've wanted for however long they were gone, for 9 months or for a year, for 15 months, is to be back in their regular lives. Who would want to think about a problem?
You're exactly right. To quote every soldier with whom I've spoken, they want to come home, have a beer, have a pizza, and spend the evening with their loved one, to paraphrase. And sure, they don't want to acknowledge a situation. They don't want to stay on base an extra 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, going through test batteries. And so the key thing to keep in mind, and I'm not going to talk about particularly about diagnostic labels, but for soldiers, for veterans, for their family members who notice that things aren't settling down after deployment, there are services available and there are effective treatments. It's not like it used to be. We understand the brain changes with PTSD, to use a label. We know how to treat it. It's different. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's normal. It's normal to learn to be afraid when your life is threatened and to apply that knowledge to your everyday environment. Who wouldn't? It's a way we survive. So if we could just get the message out that readjustment challenges are universal. And the key thing is acknowledging that they're universal and treating them as such and really raising our whole public awareness to embrace the changes that our soldiers and veterans have to go through to readjust to our communities.
Do you find that there is a greater challenge with soldiers in this culture where people are supposed to be tough and stoic, and you're trained to think about the person standing next to you before you think about yourself?
Oh, that's a very good question. My frame of reference actually is limited to my lifespan, so I really refer this back to Vietnam. I really think we're ahead of the game relative to where we were in Vietnam. I know that our soldiers after Vietnam had the very, very damaging and unfortunate experiences of coming back from horrific combat to face scorn, derision, and even antagonism by our populace at the time. I think the great thing about America currently is that we as a nation, and certainly Texas as a state, have embraced the service that our men and women are providing and the sacrifice that our soldiers' families are providing. So I think there is a real change in the culture that, in fact, is more supportive of our soldiers and veterans than at least in my decades of experience.
Do conditions like traumatic brain injury and PTSD, will they resolve on their own ever if they're not treated?
PTSD, if untreated, tends to be a chronic condition. Notice I will not embrace the word never or always because one never knows. PTSD is interesting. Certainly the symptoms can remit and resurge. For example, many folks are able to manage the symptoms by throwing themselves into work, et cetera. But I think as a rule of thumb, when your brain changes in response to a life-threatening event, which is what happens with PTSD, one needs to grapple with it in some form to truly heal. Traumatic brain injury, the physiologic changes, the physical changes to the brain, if mild enough, the brain does recover. Past a certain threshold, just as if one hits your head against a car window. If it's serious enough, again, it takes an intervention to repair the physical damage.
Dr. Catherine J. Cotrilla is my guest. She's chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Texas A&M Health Science Center. We're talking about caring for veterans' mental health this afternoon. So if you talk about a change to the brain and needing to repair it, that sounds like it would go first to drug therapy as opposed to other forms of therapy. Is that the case?
Oh, that's a very good question. With a post-traumatic stress disorder, although one of our very common antidepressants, and we call them SSRIs or serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors, most folks think of them as Prozac or Zoloft, they are shown to be effective for post-traumatic stress disorder over time, and they're a very safe medication. Interestingly, though, psychotherapy, which we think of as talk therapy, is shown to be extremely effective. But let me emphasize that this is not the lying on the couch for years at a time kind of psychotherapy that we laugh at in the New Yorker cartoons. It is rather a very structured, very focused, time-limited approach to deal with the specific trauma that is troubling the person. And there are indeed specific methods. They're called cognitive processing therapy or prolonged exposure therapy. And again, unlike what we had knowledge of after Vietnam, these are evidence-based. They are known to be effective either with the recovery from combat-related stress or indeed with the recovery from sexual assault-related stress, which is, in fact, our number one cause of PTSD in America.
And I guess that sexual assault sometimes is sort of has originated with people who were supposed to be fighting on the same side.
Exactly, exactly. And you've highlighted another complicating factor in this war that we've really not experienced before, and that is, of course, 20% of our fighting force is female. And you're right, associated with intense combat is an increased amount of military-related sexual trauma, be it either male on female or indeed men are unfortunately survivors of sexual assault as well. And while that is, again, a horrifying thought, I guess if there's any light at the end of that tunnel, it is that, again, we have effective treatment for it. Indeed, right here in Dallas, there is an extremely effective military-related sexual trauma program that's taking place at the VA. We're one of the centers of expertise and excellence in that regard. So while it's an awful thing, at least in Texas, we have the available treatment to help folks cope with such awful situations.
Are we, in your opinion, doing enough to keep our soldiers mentally healthy while they're in the field? Is there anything we can do for them while they're fighting and experiencing this trauma, aside from, I guess, soldier-on-soldier sexual violence? But for those that are in battle, can we protect them better than we are?
My understanding, and I have to qualify this with I have not been deployed, but my understanding from what soldiers tell me is that we have hugely enhanced our capacity for mental health services in field. I know we have forward groups of providers who do provide services in field. I know that medications that we discussed earlier, the SSRIs, are utilized, as are medications to help soldiers sleep. Frankly, when you are facing chronic, day-long threat to your life, which is a situation in Iraq, where every garbage bag by the side of the road may contain an improvised explosive device that could end your life and your friend's life, and even more sadly, where every civilian coming towards you may have explosive devices strapped to them, including children, I don't know what you can do to obviate the learned fear that every component of your environment is dangerous.
We'll return to our conversation about caring for veterans' mental health in just a moment. My guest is Dr. Catherine J. Cotterla. She is chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Texas A&M Health Science Center. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about caring for veterans' mental health with Dr. Catherine J. Cotrilla. She's a psychiatrist in town for a conference on Operation Healthy Reunions. That's a program administered by Mental Health America of Greater Dallas. It supports health care and case management for veterans who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan and for their families. And that leads me to something. None of this happens in a vacuum. People don't come home and suddenly deal with their problems all by themselves. Soldiers also are often dropped right back into families who've assumed that when mom or dad or son or daughter is back, things will be exactly as they were before. And you have, I guess, families who've been very worried about the safety of their loved one all this time.
Absolutely. And let me give you one quote that for some reason caught at my heart from the beginning. One veteran said to me, "Someone should have told my wife I would be different." And I think it's true for spouses. I know it's true for children because particularly with multiple deployments, because some of our soldiers have been deployed two or three or four times, say half of their child's life if their child is six or less. And they don't know that child the same way as someone who's been at home the whole time. Moreover, what soldiers tell me over and over again is that while they were gone and they were changing, their family likewise was growing and was adapting and was living without them. So they were changing too. So when the soldier comes home, not only is he or she having to readjust to life in America, as we were discussing, but they're having to readjust really to a new family and a new marriage and a new role as parents. And it's not easy on anybody.
Is there someone to tell soldiers, husbands and wives, that they'll be different? I mean, is that starting to happen now?
It is starting to happen. There are many services available. For example, you mentioned Mental Health America and Operation Healthy Reunion. There are family readiness groups through the National Guard, the Department of Defense, which is associated with our active duty soldiers, has many programs. What it seems to me is that there are many services available. There are well-intentioned people. But somehow we do not make the connection. We are not fully ready to say, you know what, readjustment's going to be an issue. We haven't normalized it to the extent that everybody signs up for it. In fact, we know that of our veterans who come home, around 10% seek services. Well, if someone's saying to me, no soldier comes home unchanged and every soldier is different and every family faces readjustment, well, maybe we should just treat it as such. So,
mandate treatment?
Not mandate treatment. No. What I'm saying is destigmatize the readjustment challenges and destigmatize it for the soldier and the spouse and the kids. I guess for what I'm trying to say is I see this as a call to our community and our state, that we are all aware of the challenges our families are going to face. And that is particularly true, I believe, for our Guard and Reserve families. We know, actually, our Guard and Reserve soldiers are experiencing more distress. And if you look at the circumstances in Texas for our Guard and Reserve families who are scattered and isolated and who are often not supported during deployment in rural regions of Texas, I just really urge all of us in our faith homes and communities and in our workplaces where we are rubbing elbows with these people to just be sensitive to this issue.
What do we know about substance abuse rates for soldiers who come back as compared with the general population?
We don't know the answer yet. That's an excellent question. We know that on return, there is a spike. We do not know the percentage. We know there is a spike in alcohol abuse. That is what clinicians are telling me. I haven't seen any published reports yet. But alcohol abuse is a big problem on return. Veterans use it so they can sleep to avoid the nightmares that are associated with the memories. The terrible thing is with the alcohol abuse, you have less impulse control, and someone who's depressed and not doing well, who has access to a firearm, that's where you so often end up with the tragedy of a veteran taking his or her own life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about caring for the mental health of our veterans with Dr. Catherine J. Cotrilla. She's chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Texas A&M Health Science Center. Our number, again, 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Tom in Dallas. Hello, Tom.
Hi, good afternoon. I appreciate the show very much. I don't hear anyone talking about violence as the natural state of man. I can tell you when I underwent military training, I was changed. And I think anyone that gets a gun in their hand and is taught to kill, it changes you. But I also felt to a degree that it's something very natural for me to be with men and be running and doing very physical things. And we evolved from beings that faced threats of violence, multiple times during the day, whether we had to procure food, reproductive resources, shelter. And I'm wondering if that can be tied in somehow to helping us, that this is our natural state somewhat, and we just need to deal with it. You might disagree with me, doctor, I don't know, but it somehow helped me dealing with things just to know that at times man is violent.
No, I think that is really an excellent and indeed fascinating reframing of the whole situation. So I very much appreciate your comments and indeed your openness to saying how natural it felt to you. And you're absolutely right. Evolutionarily, a big component of our being and survival involved violence. There's a reason we have that capacity. And I guess the challenge is certainly in our society, it's not adaptive when we come home. And I guess what you have beautifully articulated, in fact, is the challenge of leaving it behind, if indeed that is possible, or at least finding a place where you're comfortable in readjusting to civilian life. And I know that many veterans struggle profoundly with that. So I think you raise a lot of key and indeed fundamental issues.
Every soldier obviously comes into a deployment with different life experiences and backgrounds and genetic history and all that. But I'm wondering if there's any really good research to explain why one person who has been in the same situation suffers horribly after, and another seems to be pretty resilient.
There's no definitive research. That's a great question. There are suggestions in research, and let me talk about a couple strands. And one thing is, as you know, now we have a volunteer army. And we do know that people are more vulnerable to PTSD and to a negative outcome after exposure to trauma if they have already endured trauma. That is, if as a child they were exposed to either physical or sexual abuse, which unfortunately a number of our soldiers were, so that makes them vulnerable to trauma as opposed to someone who had not experienced abuse. And then we are also actively investigating the genetic component of resiliency to or vulnerability to PTSD. And those questions are out there, and hopefully we'll have them answered fairly soon.
Do you think those would ever help determine who's allowed to go into battle and who's not?
I can't answer that the way the Department of Defense would answer that.
Well, answer it as you would answer it as a physician.
We certainly have amongst ourselves, because some of that research is going on in my department, as a matter of fact. So we certainly have speculated amongst ourselves that even though we respect that the Department of Defense has the mandate to maintain an overall fighting force, if you could determine who was better suited for different positions, why would you not optimize the talent that was made available to you by channeling people into optimal positions? I don't know. We were just speculating about such things.
Well, it's an interesting question because it sounds incredibly cold to talk about it in these terms, but even the money required to care for someone who is traumatized mentally following battle seems really, really high.
It is, and then as you pointed out, it really is a human tragedy. I mean, for example, while I have, I think, appropriately emphasized that PTSD is treatable, I think we're also aware that there are individuals, and they may be rare, but there are individuals for whom it does become fatal. I use the example of someone who would suicide. So if that happens once, it's too many times, and it really is intolerable. So to that end, in determining who's vulnerable and preventing that, it would be well served.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let us speak next to Bruce in Fort Worth. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I'm a master's student over at the School of Social Work, and my area of interest is PTSD. And I believe that it was Dr. Friedman, who works either in the Defense Department or with the VA, who recently published a study stating that between 62% and 92% of individuals, military individuals with PTSD, have some form of substance abuse. The other thing I'd like to point out is if it is, if the rate is as high as it is reported in Vietnam vets, 30%, that means that 70% came through the experience without having PTSD and lived normal lives. Thanks. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, I really appreciate your call and pointing that out. Yeah, Matt Friedman is absolutely wonderful. He's with the National Center for PTSD, by the way, and he is absolutely the PTSD guru. So I commend you for that. And you're right about Vietnam and the percentages for Vietnam. And I like your emphasis on the 70% of folks who did come out resilient. I'm a little bit more concerned about Iraq, and perhaps that is unfounded, at least based on the evidence of from the Iraqi and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and indeed from the RAND survey that I'm sure you're familiar with. I'm afraid the percentages seem a little bit higher to me, and moreover, we really don't know how it's going to play out with the multiple deployments, because as I'm sure this caller realizes, because he is up on the subject, the more an individual is exposed to combat, the greater the risk for PTSD. So by virtue of sending someone into combat repeated times, you inherently raise their risk of PTSD. Now, to counter that, the fact that we're sending so many Guard and Reserve, and they tend to be older, and if you're older, you have some sort of protection against PTSD. We don't know how it's going to all turn out. But nonetheless, I think Iraq is particularly problematic because there is no safe area in Iraq and people are under stress 24/7. But I still think that remains to be seen. And again, I thank the caller for pointing out that many people are very resilient and get to grow from the experience. And I also think, though, it doesn't mitigate the challenges that people can come through back home, even if they ultimately grow, and the challenges their family face as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Dr. Cotrella, the other thing that combat veterans inevitably have to cope with is grief, which is something that when it happens in sort of the civilian world, we give each other time to deal with it and we really honor this, but they're expected to sort of move on immediately. So they've got grief and then they've got survivor's guilt. At what point does that become a problem and something that keeps them from functioning properly?
And that's another excellent question. And really, you can tell that grief has become pathologic, so to speak. I said that in quotes. When it does impair functioning, i.e. when one becomes suicidal and you become obsessed and morbidly preoccupied with the grief, you become hopeless, you basically develop a major depression, and you can't get past it. Granted, grief is a natural part of loss, and there does have to be time allowed to work through it. But when it lapses over into thinking about self-harm, it's time to seek services, period.
Can a soldier who is still on active duty, who is seeking services and, in fact, taking medication, continue to serve?
Yes, unequivocally. Yes, they do seek services. They are, in fact, on medications, psychotropic medications, which is what we call psychiatric medications, antidepressants. It apparently is fairly ubiquitous. So people should seek services. Again, it is much better to take a medication than to be impaired.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We speak next to Ken in Weatherford. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I appreciate your taking my call. Your discussion is really interesting to me. I'm a multiple tour Vietnam vet, and where I was the oddity from Vietnam, most people did single tours. What we have going on now, the oddity is the guy that only gets away with one tour. I say the guy, the individual that gets away with a single tour. And I was tagged with PTSD from my Vietnam experience. And I was old when I got there on my first tour. I was 23. When I got on my second tour, I was 25. And PTSD didn't get to me till 17 years after my first tour. And it got me with the self-medication. I drank a lot. I did street drugs. I did a bunch of other things that obviously contributed to my other problems. And the thing is I think that the numbers that they're using now – PTSD, because I did for about 15 years VA and Social Security claims for veterans, and there are six guys that lost their lives, and I know that it was the PTSD that got them, but they overdosed. And
I think we've lost the connection with Ken, but if you want to go ahead and respond to what he said, very interesting points.
I really would, and I hope, Ken, you're still listening, because first I wanted to thank you for your service and thank you for calling. Your story really touched me, and I think it raises an excellent point that PTSD does recur years later. And indeed, even now with the conflict in Iraq, the VA is seeing a resurgence of people from the Vietnam era who are seeking services for the first time. Their symptoms have been worsened by seeing the news daily about the combat in Iraq. And I actually am sorry but glad you mentioned about your colleagues at work who lost their lives long-term from PTSD. If Chris will allow me, I'm reminded and moved by a patient I had in my own training, a Vietnam veteran, a gentleman who was the last of six members of his unit. And he would never tell me what he did, but the other five of his colleagues had all suicided. And I was serving him in Houston, and he had previously, on the anniversary of whatever event precipitated his PTSD, had driven down to Galveston in his pickup truck with a live grenade and drove out along the beach where he was alone and pulled the pin on that grenade, fully expecting it to explode. And when it didn't, he took it as a sign. He came back to Houston, and we managed to work together and kept him alive at least for a while. But as Ken illustrated, the long-term effects of PTSD and not receiving treatment are devastating.
My guest is Dr. Catherine J. Cotula. She's chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Texas A&M Health Science Center. We're talking about caring for the mental health of our veterans. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about caring for veterans' mental health with psychiatrist Dr. Catherine J. Cotula. We have an email from Dan to think@kera.org. He writes, a difference between World War II vets and Iraq vets seems to be that World War II vets did not rotate in and out of the war and back home. They stayed in the war theater, like my dad, for 3 years until the war was over. Are we actually making the stress of war worse by sending Iraq vets to the war theater and then home and then back to the theater?
That's an excellent question. We do know that unit cohesion, because when you describe, I'm sure your father was very bonded with the people with whom he served for 3 years. Unit cohesion is very protective in PTSD. And then I'm sure, as you know from talking to your father, even in World War II, folks had periods of combat exposure and then downtime. I do not know whether the rotation in and out actually worsens the PTSD, but certainly what soldiers tell me is that the rapidity with which they are expected to readjust to civilian life is jarring. Let me be a little bit more concrete. In World War II, your dad or my dad came back via boat. So the war was over. You unwound over 6 weeks on the boat because it took a while to cross the ocean. Whereas now, you're in Kuwait. Next day, you land in Killeen at Fort Hood. And if you're in the Garden Reserve, in 5 days, you go to Plano. So you have to get used to mentally being a civilian extraordinarily quickly, and you're not surrounded by your cohort of fellow soldiers to adapt, to readjust, to put the past behind you, to grieve, as Chris brought up earlier, to face the future. And I think that makes things tougher on our soldiers to readjust.
We had the caller earlier who brought up the subject of feeling as if it was part of his sort of natural makeup to be violent at times. We had a veteran on the show last week, and I don't want you to diagnose any mental illness issues with him, but he talked about getting to a point where he was not suicidal and he didn't want to die, but he no longer feared for his own life. He was in that place where he just couldn't think about it anymore. Is that a sign that someone's getting really close to a dangerous place, or is that healthy for functioning as a soldier?
I imagine that that is a good survival skill to have when you are facing life and death experiences every day, because I would imagine that it allows you to think clearly and not be troubled by emotion or indeed troubled by some of the physiologic arousal of fear that can keep you from being attentive.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Nish in Dallas. Hi, Nish.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Well, thanks for bringing this subject. I've treated World War II veterans, I've treated Korea veterans, I've treated people from Vietnam, of course, still have some of them. But this is different. Iraq is very different. I think what your expert guest is saying is very true. The irony is the very first patient that I diagnosed with PTSD from Iraq and tried to get some help from VA about a year and a half ago, nothing happened. I wrote letters after letters, and it was really sad the way the government started handling the situation. And I think the problems further worsened by the fact that the Army's capacity to, they just did not anticipate the extent of PTSD that's going to come out of this. And it's going to be a whole lot worse before they figure out. And I think the treatment in the VA system is a lot more fragmented right now. They're just not prepared. And I just think it's really sad. The thing I would like for people to do is when these veterans come back, you know, they're all at Terminal D trying to cheer them up when they're landing. But after that, we forget about them. I think these people literally need to be adopted by families wherever, what base they are on or in the surrounding areas to help them come back into society and be normal again. And I'll listen to you on the air, off the air now. Thank you.
Great points. Thanks so much for your call, Nish.
Yeah, I really appreciate those comments. And I guess I have at least two responses. First, I know I hear it every day in my community. I have to concur with what you're saying. There is a sense that I can't get anybody into the VA. On the other hand, I used to work for the VA. In fact, I was responsible for mental health in this part of the VA in addition to other parts of the state. And on the other hand, I know that within the VA, they really are putting more resources in mental health than in any time before, and at least relative to our public mental health system, there are more comprehensive mental health services than any other place in America. So I guess I concur with you that really what we have to do is continue that communication and reduce the barriers for every veteran that's out there. There are services available, and you're right, they need advocacy because it is not an easy system to navigate. And then my other comment, you are so right that we need as communities to put our arms around these people and their families and realize that this is the long haul. It's not just at the airport. So thank you for your remark.
Well, unit cohesion came up earlier, and we're talking about supporting these people. Do group therapy programs work as well as one-on-one therapy?
Yes, some do. Some do. For example, we were talking earlier about military-related sexual trauma. That works well. Currently, the PTSD therapies tend to be most effective one-on-one, although I know that they're changing into group therapy sessions. And just anecdotally, I know that many of our veterans love their support groups because they like talking to each other because somebody has been there, somebody understands, somebody has shared the good times and the horrific times and things that change your life. You want someone else who understands.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to John in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Hi. I'll just make this point and appreciate hearing the doctor's thing off the air. But I heard of a woman that you mentioned people are some predisposed to certain things in the military, and they might have a skill that they can do very well. And I heard of a woman that was extremely sensitive. And when she was a child, she, by her very nature, was aware the house was burning down. And it was long before anyone else in the family was aware. And because she was gifted with this natural awareness, it saved the whole family's life. And I'm wondering if a person can be screened ahead of time that has that kind of skill and be put in a position where it could help save lives in, let's say, a battlefield.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah,
that's an interesting question, and I suspect that in a unit, and when things are happening, if somebody does have that skill, and people pretty quickly figure out that somebody's figuring out that something's going on before anybody else, I imagine that sort of natural talent to ferret out risk is revealed pretty rapidly. And it's interesting because you happen to use the example of someone who was a woman, and what that brings to mind is what I've heard people have told me, which is that with our 20% women soldiers these days, and perhaps I'm only bringing this up because I'm a female as well, that people are very much relieved when they have a woman looking out for them, perhaps because we're so attentive and watchful and pay attention to make sure we're going to keep everybody safe. So I'm glad you use that specific example.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Buster in Fort Worth. Hi, Buster.
Hi. I just wanted to touch on something the doctor just brought up a minute ago, the difference between the World War II and Korea and the Vietnamese veterans. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I mean, like she said, you know, those previous wars, they had 30 to 40 days of ship time processing together to unwind and decompress. When I got on the plane to come back to the United States, they held our plane. A Jeep comes sliding up to the plane. A guy got out. He handed his weapon over, checked him, make sure he didn't have any grenades or anything on him, and he came right straight from the field. Somebody packed his bag, and he got on the plane and off to the United States. 24 hours later, he's sitting on the street. I think that's part of our problem that we face is it doesn't give our guys a chance to decompress and this continue. I think like one of the people said earlier, if we could keep them in place longer instead of these short-term back and forth, it would probably be less stressful on them because if nothing else, the goodbyes get harder each time. Thank you all. I'll listen on the radio.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for your comments, Buster, and you really did highlight what you experienced as a stress in Vietnam that a lot of people recognized, and sadly, not only did you come back so quickly, but folks in Vietnam came back alone, which was very hard on people, and as you described, would sit at an airport in civvies and be isolated. And as you were talking, I was reminded of something else that's different that adds perhaps an additional stress on our families. As you know, now our soldiers are so electronically connected, and families keep up electronically, and they see exactly what's happening on the news and through email and whatnot. And I really have to wonder how this is impacting our kids and our spouses and our parents, because the war can be so immediate to them, not only that their soldier is safe, but also the risks and the dangers. So this is an unknown, and with the new technology, we'll just have to see the impact on everybody.
It's an interesting point that you brought up about the immediacy of email contact. I know a lot of soldiers like the fact that they're able to communicate on a regular basis, but suddenly people who used to only have to worry about fighting and writing a letter once a week are getting emails about the air conditioner going out and having to choose private school for a kid and, you know, really sort of quotidian things on top of having to worry about life and death situation.
Yes, and while it does keep them connected, sadly, it can also precipitate additional stress. And it's not the choosing the school necessarily, but it's your spouse is divorcing you because they found somebody new, which can precipitate a lot of depression and, again, thoughts of suicide in fields. So I don't have an answer for this. It's a double-edged sword. The good news is that parents can stay connected to their children and spouses can stay connected. We'll just have to see.
Let's speak next to Wayne in Watauga. Hi, Wayne.
Hello. Listen, I'm not a combat vet, but I was the first on the scene after my wife's murder a few years ago.
I'm sorry.
I was diagnosed with chronic PTSD. And conventional counseling and drug therapy don't seem to be effective for me. I was wondering if there's any new therapies that are showing any promise for people who aren't responsive to normal therapy, and I'll take your answer off the phone.
Thanks.
And like Chris said, I'm very, very sorry, Wayne. And as I mentioned, the two therapies that have shown to be effective for post-traumatic stress disorder are called cognitive processing therapy, or CPT, and the other is prolonged exposure therapy, or PET. That's not your standard go to someone's office once a week. They're very manualized and specialized, and I can leave information about those therapies here at the radio station.
Great. What do you think is changing for the better in terms of the way we all as a society understand the problem?
I think that there's a greater awareness, like this show that you're having, that this is a normal experience, that this does not show weakness. It's not necessarily a mental disorder, that this war brings about stresses. Yes, we give it a label. We call it post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's the way the brain responds to fear. Traumatic brain injury is an injury. And the key thing, I think, is this groundswell of support, as we've discussed, for our soldiers and their families. So I have a lot of hope for our society. Likewise, because I live down in Central Texas, I have a lot of hope for our state. Our elected officials are joining together with our civilians, our VAs, to try and work together to get our hands around this problem in a way we didn't do with Vietnam.
The reason for it, I suppose, is very sad, but there's been a lot of advancements in prosthetic technology since this war has happened because so many people have come back badly wounded. Is the same thing happening, do you think, for mental health and traumatic brain injury?
I wish I could say yes, because you're right about the advancements in prosthetics. I think that traumatic brain injury is still a new frontier, and I think what we could hope for there is to recognize it. I think that we are in good shape with respect to PTSD, as I mentioned, because there's treatment for it, there's rehabilitation for it. And again, despite the frustrations that were voiced by callers earlier with the VA, there is more money than ever, both for mental health treatment and for vocational rehabilitation and substance abuse treatment. So I think we should count our blessings, ironically, when we're looking at mental health issues. And again, I think it is so important because we recognize what people have sacrificed. And I'm not sure we did that after Vietnam.
Dr. Catherine Cotrella is chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Texas A&M Health Science Center. You can learn more about the program she's been involved in, Operation Healthy Reunions, at mhadallas.org. Dr. Cotrella, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.